This is an ABC podcast.
What do you want for budget?
We're calling on the government to work with the states and add 25,000 social housing properties to housing stock each year.
While the small business is vulnerable and it's difficult to compete with big, who have always had the upper hand, why not now start looking at ways to make that more fair and equitable?
The number one issue that businesses are talking to us about now is people. In fact, that's the top three issues: people, people, people.
We don't need a government that just wants to get out of the way. We actually have demonstrated over the last 2 years, we need a government that's capable of doing things and doing them fast when needed.
Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. This is The Money. And today we have four different perspectives on what ought to be in the budget. You'll hear from Alexi Boyd from COSBOA, the Council of Small Business Organisations, Innes Willocks at the Australian Industry Group, and Kate Colvin from Everybody's Home. Let's start with Cassandra Goldie, the CEO at ACOS.
The last thing we need right now is for the government to be cutting away at critical investments in expenditures. If we focus on the investments, including in full employment, then what we will do is be able to look at the deficit and to start to tackle the debt position over time in a responsible way. We can't make the mistakes that we made after the global financial crisis, where we effectively had austerity and what we saw, years of sluggish economic progress. And that's because we'd really cut away at the adequacy of the supports for people in the bottom 40% of the community, where the real economy lies when it comes to capacity to spend and to help to keep other people in jobs.
Basically, you're talking about there really the settings of the budget at the moment. We've got public expenditure set to fall over the next 4 years and then only growing very slightly at 1.4% from 24-25. I want to dig into some of the meat of your submission, because you've made, I would call it, a comprehensive submission to Treasury Cass. I'll just touch on a few of the proposals. Social Security, what do you want to happen there?
Well, in 2020, for the first time in almost 30 years, we saw the government move to lift the adequacy of the unemployment payment, JobSeeker, to something that was more adequate for people to be able to cover the cost of essentials like housing and food. We've had an unemployment payment which has been one of the lowest in the OECD. Well, it's been cut right back to $46 per day, and it is one of the key reasons that we still have the level of poverty in Australia. It's time for us to fix the adequacy of Social Security. Let's get the social protections adequate for the long term that we need now, which means income support if you are hit by unemployment. And then, of course, we want to see a movement on housing.
So hang on,
because that's the other key area.
Hang on, $46 a day now. What do you want it to be?
We want it to be $70 a day. That would lift it to the same rate as the pension rate, as the minimum that people need to be able to cover the cost of the basics. If you're in private rental, we want to see Commonwealth rent assistance, which has also been frozen for almost 30 years, that lifted by 50% to finally be something more adequate. And then some supplementary payments, which would be appropriate, for example, if you've got a disability or illness.
All right. This is the Raise the Rate campaign, which is pretty well
known.
That's
right.
What about employment, Cass? What would you like to see change there?
Well, one of the good news stories coming out of this pandemic, and we need to find them, is that we do have a historic opportunity to really go for full employment. We've got a headline rate of unemployment which is relatively low, but if we don't do this well now and stay the course, we won't open up the employment opportunities for people who have been locked out of paid work for for a long time. Let's remember that we've still got 30% more people relying on Social Security in Australia because they're not getting enough paid work or they've been longer term unemployed and employers weren't giving them a chance. So we want to see a flexible jobs and training guarantee for people who have been long term unemployed. Let's invest properly in that skills and education and training for people so that they are getting to the front of the queue and getting a chance to get some of these great jobs that are out there, including in our care sector and other critical areas like tourism and retail.
What about that issue of compliance if you're unemployed?
Well, again, we've had a history in Australia of cranking up the get tough. You know, the problem if you're on Social Security is that you're not trying hard enough to get into the labour market, which is, you know, really meant that we've had a politics on this, which is just this make the rules harder, threaten people with being cut off from their income support if they don't turn up for one single appointment, and without understanding that the reality is what we did in 2020 was we lifted those mutual obligations, and many people said for the first time they got out of chronic stress with, you know, being threatened with being cut off from the life-giving income support, which pays for your housing and your food.
Now, when governments talk about budgets, they like to talk about tax cuts. I haven't asked you about tax, but you're clearly after a more progressive distribution.
Well, we often talk first about tax and revenue because, of course, that is what creates the capacity for us to deliver on the critical things that communities need. We don't need a government that just wants to get out of the way. We actually have demonstrated over the last 2 years we need a government that's capable of doing things and doing them fast when needed. And so our revenue base is not adequate. We went into the pandemic with this arbitrary cap on revenue to GDP, which is baked in austerity to the Australian federal budget. Let's be clear, the federal budget papers already are only proposing sort of a reduction in public expenditure per person over the next 2 years. So that's a cut to expenditures and then less than 2% growth over the next 2 years. How are we going to fund what we need to do in aged care? How are we going to fund the mental health services that we know that we need? How are we going to tackle the housing affordability? And certainly, how are we going to do the right thing when it comes to disaster resilience and being able to move quickly and with strength when it comes to humanitarian responses here in Australia, overseas as well, and making sure that we've got the capabilities built into our government systems to do what the community really demonstrated it wants. So those stage three tax cuts, I've highlighted that they are extraordinarily unfair. $16 billion they'll cost the budget once they're in 2024. That two-thirds of them are going to men who have already got jobs on higher incomes. What are we doing with that? So we have to, as a country, look at what our tax system is doing to collect the revenue that we need. We need to be focusing on the investments for people in the bottom 40% of the income brackets and then raising revenue to make sure that we do have the resources for essential services like health, education and childcare.
Cassandra Goldie from the Australian Council of Social Services. This is The Money with me, Richard Aidy. Today, we're hearing what different groups want from the budget. And next, it's Alexi Boyd at the Council of Small Business Organisations.
Well, essentially, we're recognising that small businesses have received a lot of fiscal stimulus in the last couple of years to support them through their COVID disastrous journey. And what we're seeing now is we're looking for the government to be offering structural reforms. So let's look at the future of the next couple of years of rebuilding businesses as they emerge from the COVID crisis.
Because we know that a number of small businesses haven't got through what's happened over the last 2 years. And a lot of small businesses, well, people who run them are exhausted.
Absolutely. And they continue to be very vulnerable right now. They don't have the team of HR people within their organisation, the lawyers to be able to unpack all of the regulation and the compliance that they need to do, just simply to run their businesses on a day-to-day basis. And it makes it quite difficult with making sure that they can utilise that time to be running their business instead of trying to work through all the regulation that is needed these days. So what we're talking about is saying to the government, you know, while the small business is vulnerable and it's difficult to compete with big, who have always had the upper hand, why not now start looking at ways to make that more fair and equitable?
All right. So one of the things you've touched on, I guess, is regulation. What are the regulation issues you want sorted out?
Well, industrial relations has always been a bit of a dog's breakfast. It's very complex, and trying to understand the myriad of requirements around overtime and minimum number of hours that a person can work, the different allowances that are incorporated into a lot of the modern awards. So what we're saying is, let's look at the industrial relations situation, make it simpler, make it easier for small businesses to do the right thing, and come down hard on those who are not doing the right thing.
So that's not something that Josh Frydenberg will be announcing in the budget. That's kind of further down the track, isn't it? Another thing you've highlighted is industry associations. Now, you're an industry association, but why industry associations as kind of the priority channel, if I could put it that way?
When we're talking about professional associations, they have really worked hard over the last couple of years to support small businesses to make sure they access the right support, translate what the government is expecting of them on a day-to-day basis, and help small businesses through this journey. They continue to be a trusted source of information, training, and support between businesses, from mentoring capacities, for example. What we're saying is, if there is funding that is going out into the broader community to support small businesses, funnel that funding through associations who are already doing the right thing and making sure that compliance and requirements are being met. So let's really funnel that into the right direction where small businesses are already going. The other pathway, of course, is trusted advisors. Small businesses have really leaned on them to unpack everything. Let's continue to support them in their journey.
Yeah. Alexia, I think that gets us to the third thing which you're really after, which is targeted, needs-based support kind of post-COVID. What would you like to see?
Well, that's exactly right. There's a recognition that a number of industries continue to be hard hit and are needing support. So I guess this is around the conversations. Continue to talk to industry groups, find out where the needs are really required, and then work with those to find out where the most hard hit industries continue to be struggling, such as live music, for example. That continues to be problematic. The events industry has continued to be disrupted. So look at what we can do to support those industries, because these are thriving businesses who, without the impost of COVID, were running successful businesses into the future. And we don't want to see the loss of an entire industry. And what's important about continuing to support small business is, if we don't support them, then we'll lose them from community. And I don't think anybody out there wants to look at their community and see the same thing from one suburb to the next being exactly the same, which will ultimately be big business if we don't look after them.
You want to address some issues with workforce shortages. What are you after?
Well, what we're hearing from our members is the next 12 to 18 months will continue to be problematic with workforce shortages. We need to alleviate any of the hurdles that are stopping people who want to engage with work in Australia from doing so. So that's, where are the restrictions around certain visas, for example? Let's lift those restrictions, at least temporarily, so we can get more people engaging, particularly in the unskilled sectors, with work. There are groups such as pensioners, there are groups such as working parents who are restricted around tax blockages like family tax benefits A and B or their pension. We don't want to see them financially disadvantaged because they want to work more hours. So what can be done in this regard to make sure that people have the ability to work longer or work in different places if they choose to, and support small businesses in this time of worker shortage crisis?
You've also talked a bit about insurance, Alexia. What's the issue there?
Well, insurance has been quite dysfunctional for a number of years now, and we're hearing increasing number of sectors where businesses are actually completely uninsurable. These are businesses who can quite happily open. There's no problem with them. They're trading just fine, but they're actually uninsurable, which means they have to close their doors. And that's happening in an increasing number of sectors. We're also hearing about 20, 30, 40% increases across the board for things like professional indemnity insurance if you're a consultant, right the way through to public liability if you've got people coming through the door. So it's something that needs to be looked at quite carefully. There's going to need to address, obviously, the issue of climate change in certain areas. What's the solution there? But this is a whole of government approach we're going to need to resolve. If you think about one business being affected by being uninsured, then that affects potentially the entire supply chain.
Right. You also want the government to make some changes in competition policy.
Exactly. We'd like to see the ACCC properly funded to ensure that they are regulating the industry to make it a situation that's more equitable for small versus big. So obviously, like I mentioned before, if we remove small businesses out of community, it will be replaced by big. They are particularly vulnerable right now to takeovers. We need to make sure that process is fair and that we continue to see competition within community so we don't end up with monopolies in particular areas. You know, we don't want to see one giant supermarket and no option for competition in any area.
All right, Alexi, that is where we'll leave it. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to COSBOA.
Alexi Boyd's the Chief Executive at the Council of Small Business Organisations. On The Money Today, we're hearing what different sectors want from the budget. Innes Willicks represents the employers. He runs the Australian Industry Group. And his request begins with no tax increases or new taxes.
Well, Richard, it's important because our economy is really at an inflection point. We've just gone through what has been really a once-in-a-century economic shock. We've come through that COVID first hit, you know, relatively very well compared to other economies. We have low unemployment, we have high participation, all of those things. We still face enormous challenges. We face challenges both in the short and the long term. And to overburden, you know, our business community and the community more generally with more taxes at this time is not the right path to take. This budget has to be about setting the course for the future. And, you know, that has to be ways to stimulate the economy in the short term, build for the longer term, and work towards programs of debt recovery. But they've got to be over the longer term too. We're going to have deficits for a long time. We just need to accept that.
You also want the stimulus measures already announced to be maintained. Now, I don't imagine the Treasurer will take any of them away, but what specifically is important?
Well, it's important, Richard, that measures that were announced in the height of COVID, if I can call it that, and we're obviously going through another phase of it right at the moment with lots of cases, but those measures have provided business and the community more broadly with significant comfort as we've gone through this, and has also allowed business and households to plan, to build into their thinking that these measures will be in place when they said that they would be. So to offer them up and then take them away, you know, would be a dent to confidence and would also be a dent to continuity and planning. So stick with what's been promised and deliver that. I think that's very important. Where you've got to look is what other additional measures are necessary in the current environment.
So the infrastructure, which the government has focused on and talked a great deal about, but also things like the expensing of capital investment, you want that to stay, and the low and middle income tax offsets at the beginning of the next financial year as well.
That's correct. They've been planned for, they've been expected, so we see no reason for them to be taken away. They're confidence building measures, and we're still at a point where our economy needs confidence to emerge from this phase. There's a whole lot of problems facing our economy at the moment, a whole lot of issues around skills, around training, around investment. All of those have to be addressed, how we address climate change going forward, big long-term issues that we need to look at.
And I'll come to some of them shortly. But one thing that I did notice in your submission was a greater use of loans rather than the non-repayable support payments, which have really characterised what has been a lot of the government's fiscal response to the pandemic.
Well, that's right. And we've got to move to a newer phase. And we've always been advocates for at least looking at loans where they're possible for businesses, in particular, loans rather than straight out grants. And there's then some mutual obligation on both. It makes businesses think harder about what they actually need and want. And that's fair enough that they do that. So it's, you know, not as simple as basically throwing money out the door. There needs to be a lot more work goes into it, but you get that economic accountability as a result.
One of the things that I know you're interested in and you'll be looking for from the Treasurer is measures to encourage growth in incomes. Of course, incomes have not been growing, but you ground them firmly in growth in productivity. What are some of the measures you'd like to see?
Let's just step back a bit. If we're going to get sustained wage and sustainable wage increases, they have to be grounded in productivity. You have to get a return to make those wage increases stick. It's a two-way street. So we do need to focus on the productivity equation. And just like wage increases have been relatively low for many years, so has productivity. We've had flatlining productivity for well over a decade now. So we need to look at measures around the take-up of digital infrastructure, the development of digital skills, the development of skills capacity more broadly across our economy. The number one issue that businesses are talking to us about now is people. In fact, that's the top three issues: people, people, people. So we need to put a big focus in the development of our what is known as human capital. We need to look at infrastructure. We've seen massive problems in recent months with problems around supply chains. So that's everything from ports, containers, pallets, trucking, logistics and the like. We've got to try to find ways to improve our productivity there. We need to look at our infrastructure priorities and to improve our productivity outcomes from those as well. They're the sort of areas that are going to be essential. Now, we can have a conversation around where workplace relations fits into all of that, and that's a separate conversation. But people often just can say workplace relations equals productivity. There's much more to it than that.
One thing I was struck by was you raised the issue of micro-credentials. This is still nascent, really, in Australia. And we still have to agree on standards, so what micro-credential is worth what. But I was interested that you highlighted it.
Well, the reason we highlight it, Richard, is it's because this is very much a path that industry and businesses are going down. And there's a lot of conversation now with the university sector, the tertiary sector, the vocational education and training sector around what they can deliver to meet what the needs of business are. And business is looking more and more to get more refined in terms of what it wants and needs from its workforce. One area to particularly look is around that development of and use of, you know, the digital skills, automation, robotics, machine learning, all of that. You've had the emergence of cyber as a huge challenge to business. All of these things, how do you put them into something that's like a micro-credential that works for business, either an individual business or a sector of the economy as well?
Innes Willacks is Chief Executive of the Australian Industry Group. And this is The Money on RN, or wherever you get your podcasts. Richard Ady with you. Everyone you've heard from so far represents an interest: social services, small business, the employers. The woman you're about to meet speaks for a campaign. Kate Colvin is with Everybody's Home, which is trying to address the housing crisis.
Look, we've got a housing crisis because so many people across Australia are either paying too much for housing so they can't afford the other basics in life, or they're being squeezed out of housing altogether and they're homeless. So we have got increasing homelessness. But just to give you an example of people who receive Commonwealth Rent Assistance, so that's already people who are on a lower income, 45.7% of them spend more than 30% of their income on housing, even after getting that benefit.
Yeah. So what is the solution to this? What do you want to happen?
Look, the main problem that we have is a structural problem in the housing market, which is that there's not enough low-cost rentals. And the reason for that is that we have market failure in the housing market. So it's simply not financially viable for an investor to buy land, build a property on that land, and then rent it to someone who's on a low income at a rent they can afford, because the cost of land is so high, they would rent it at a higher rate. So when we have market failure like that, it's really important for government to step in, and that's why we're calling for the government to invest in social and affordable housing so that those properties are provided into the market. And that gives a benefit not just to the person who ends up living in that property, but it also takes the heat out of that cheaper end of the rental market.
So how many do we have now? How many are we building now, and how many do we need to build?
Look, a lot of research has gone into what is the shortfall of social and affordable housing. And a study in 2018 by the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute concluded that there was more than 430,000 shortage of social housing properties, and that that was going to grow by 2036 to a shortfall of 730,000 properties. So that's a huge, you know, shortage of these kinds of properties in the market.
So how many should the government be either building or helping to build every year to address that?
We're calling on the government to work with the states and add 25,000 social housing properties to housing stock each year. That would go a long way to progressively reducing that overall shortage. It's unfortunately, it's a situation that you can't turn around. You know, you can't just sort of build 430,000 properties overnight. You have to do it through a pipeline of investment to build properties each year.
25,000 a year, how would the Treasurer fund that?
There's a number of ways. You know, obviously the simplest is direct investment by the government providing capital grants to community housing or supporting the states. But there are other ways that it can be develop. So one of the ideas is to create an affordable growth fund, like a sort of future fund, which is an off-budget fund that then invests in shares and other kind of investments and use the returns from that to invest in social housing over time. Another way is to encourage private sector investment into affordable housing by providing a subsidy to meet the gap between what it costs to produce low-cost rental housing and what renters can afford to pay. So you can make the production of that kind of housing profitable enough that you would have super funds investing, you would have other private sector investors investing. So all the heavy lifting doesn't have to be done by government, but there have been mountains of reports. I mean, you could build houses out of the number of reports that have been written.
You could certainly insulate a house with all the reports that have been written. You could put them in your roof space. You really could.
And the very consistent narrative from report after report after report is that it's not possible to build housing for the lowest income households that doesn't have a government subsidy in it.
You've talked about several different ways of funding getting towards 25,000 additional social and affordable houses a year. So they're going to be different costs, but what are we talking about? What are the ballparks here?
To really be making a dent, the research that identified that shortfall of social housing talked about an investment program to get to that 730,000 shortfall by 2036 of that would have been 35,000 properties a year. And the cheapest way of resourcing that would have cost $5 billion a year. So we are talking about quite a significant investment.
Yeah.
But one of the issues around that investment is that it actually would deliver more to the community in terms of reduced costs to government, reduced costs in the community from issues that are created by people not being well housed, as well as the actual construction of the houses itself creates a huge economic benefit.
And this, all of this, whatever approach the government could take, would take time. What would make a difference to people's lives right now that Josh Frydenberg could announce next week and it would make a difference by, say, the next financial year?
One thing that would make an immediate benefit is increasing Commonwealth rent assistance. So we did see in 2020 when we were in the middle of lockdowns and we had the coronavirus supplement, which effectively doubled people's job seeker payment, that the number of people who are in rental stress after receiving Commonwealth rent assistance dramatically decreased. So it's 45% of people are spending more than 30% of their income on housing now who receive Commonwealth rent assistance. But when JobSeeker was doubled, it was down to 29%. So that's a massive improvement.
Yeah, absolutely. Kate, that is where we'll leave it. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kate Colvins, the spokesperson for the Everybody's Home campaign. Next week, we'll be looking at what's actually in the budget. The Money is produced by Kate McDonald. Our sound engineer is Tim Jenkins. I'm Richard Aidy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.